I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Hi, how are you? It is May 7th, 2013. It's a beautiful spring day in New York, and I'm so glad to be here. I've been on this crazy whirlwind three-state tour the last few weeks. We were in California, as you know, premiering the Swingin' Gourmets, and that was so much fun a few weeks ago. And if you're curious or want the Swingin' Gourmets to come to you, just let me know, because what we're wanting to do is spread this message about delicious plant-based food and making it fun and making it swing. Send me an email at info@realmeals.org. And, you know, you can always send me an email at info@realmeals.org about anything, well, related to food, because that's my favorite subject. Okay. So then after California, I was in Florida. I gave a whole bunch of talks. And the thing that I realize over and over again, I'm always so excited about what's going on in the food movement. There are so many wonderful, wonderful things happening. And then I step outside of my box, my world, and I get back into reality, and I realize there's a lot more work that needs to be done. So we stick to it. And I want to bring on my first guest, who's really making strides in this food movement. This is a major game changer. Josh Tetrick is the CEO and founder of Beyond Eggs, a sustainable food company. He's a social entrepreneur, writer, and speaker. He has led a United Nations business initiative in Kenya. He has worked for both former President Clinton and the president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and taught street children as a Fulbright scholar in Nigeria and South Africa. Josh is a graduate of Cornell University and the University of Michigan Law School. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you. I'm good to be here.
Yeah. Okay. So my sound is a little funny here, so I hope it gets better.
I can hear you. Okay. Can you hear me?
Oh,
okay?
Hi. That sounds better.
There we go.
There we go. All this high tech. I love high tech, but sometimes it gets a little loopy. Well, Josh, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. You are doing something amazing for the planet with Hampton Creek Foods and Beyond Eggs. And I'm so excited about the products that you're coming up with and all of the press that you've been getting as well.
Thank you. I think you know what it is, and you feel it when you're out there, that there's a sense, and this relates to what we think about and feel every single day, that our food system is just broken. And it's so broken, it's almost absurd how broken it is. And some people are aware of it. And, you know, we say, we look out there, and it's not just in the U.S., but it's around the world, too. It's broken because of how damaging it is to our health, rising rates of diabetes and heart disease. It's broken because of its impact on the environment. It's broken because of how rough it is on animals. And when we look out there, you know, our first idea is, you know, where do we start? And yep. We decided as a company to start out with the egg industry, because for us, it's really the epitome of invisible unsustainability. I'll tell you a couple of reasons why. Number one, it's massive. About 1.8 trillion eggs are laid every single year around the world. Trillion eggs. And whether you're in Birmingham, Alabama, where I was raised, or you're in Beijing, China, 99% of all of these eggs come from exactly the same place. These disgusting, filthy industrial warehouses packed with egg-laying hens crammed into cages so small they can't flap their wings. All these hens are fed all of this feed that requires all this land and water and oil and fertilizer, which is part of the reason it's so environmentally inefficient. Avian flu outbreaks happen because of the confinement of the egg-laying hens. And we just look at that, and honestly, we just shake our head. We just think, is this really the 21st century? do we really have to, you know, get our eggs from this antiquated system? This is like horse and buggy day. So what our goal at Hampton Creek is to take the animal entirely out of the equation, to take the egg-laying hen in these crammed, filthy conditions out of the equation, and replace her egg with plants that do exactly the same thing as her egg does, whether it's bind the cookie or make a muffin rise or hold oil and water together or mayonnaise, and also pretty soon actually create a plant-based scrambled egg. And we've been lucky enough in the last year or so to have been selected by Bill Gates, one of three companies shaping the future of food, and are really excited about, you know, all the joy that people have around what we're doing.
It's very exciting. I like to quote my dad from time to time. He likes to say, if you can't solve the problem, eliminate the problem. And you've done just that. You've eliminated the problem portion of this food product, and that's the chicken and everything that is surrounding how we raise chickens for eggs today.
Yeah. Your dad, we have a little motto that we love here by this guy named Buckminster Fuller. He's a futurist, sure. And he talks about this idea of, you know, you can fight back at an absurd system in a lot of ways, but one way that you can fight back on it is to create a whole new system that makes that system obsolete.
And exactly, you know,
I think your dad has the right idea.
And that's part of solving so many problems. People can't see beyond the conflict, but what they need to see is they need to take a completely different path. Now, one of the things people often say is that we can't afford to do things differently with our energy problem, with our food problem, but it seems like with what you're doing with your company is it's actually going to be more economical to use your product.
Yeah, and when you think about it, part of the reason it actually is more economical, we're about 18% less expensive than those battery cage eggs. So this is not 18% less expensive than cage-free eggs, or 18% less expensive than free-range eggs. It's 18% less expensive than the most unsustainable, environmentally inefficient, cruel, abusive, unsafe eggs. And there's a big reason why. We don't have the animal involved in our process. And the animal, you know, whether you look at it because you care about the animal or whether you look at it because you care about economic efficiency, the animal, in this case an egg-laying hen, is getting stuffed, as we're speaking right now, with soy and corn. Right this second, hundreds of millions of egg-laying hens are gobbling up soy and corn. And 70% of the cost of every single egg comes directly from the feed that we give the chickens. So we just think that's crazy. And we just say, just grow it instead.
Exactly. It seems so obvious. Now, I've watched a few videos on your company, and you've got this great factory with a lot of wonderful scientists doing a variety of different jobs. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what's going on at Hampton Creek Foods.
Yeah, part of what we realized in starting this endeavor is, you know, there's so much innovation on our iPhone. You know, you can actually tell someone's blood count and heart rate through iPhone applications. But when it comes to innovation, in the food, man, it is a stark landscape. So what we tried to do in bringing together a team is bring people who don't necessarily have a deep experience in food, but are amazing scientists, together with people who do have a really deep experience in food. And a good example of that is we have a guy named Joshua Klein, who heads our protein team. And Joshua has a degree from Caltech in biochemistry, used to work with the Nobel laureate on a program to find a cure for AIDS and HIV. And Josh works side by side our chef, this guy named Chris Jones. He doesn't know a whole lot about biochemistry, but is a wickedly creative chef. He used to work for a restaurant called Modo, which was named Food & Wine's Best Restaurants for 2 years in a row. And they work alongside a woman named Shweta Rao, who's our director of baking, who spent a number of years in Otis Funkmeyer. So that's the idea in creating this team, is we want to bring radically different perspectives together to try to search the world's plant species, because only about 8% of them actually have been explored for their functionality in food. I mean, it is just a wide open area. And we spend every single day searching and then plugging those plants into things like mayonnaise and cookies and even scrambled eggs.
Well, I think we can make food taste even better than what we've been used to. Now, can I ask you a question? I saw in this one video where you taste conventional foods made with eggs, and then you try and duplicate them made with your product. Where do you get your eggs from that you compare your product with?
So because we are you know, really trying to be apples to apples. We do use the exact same egg that the company that we're working with is using, just to show them that we don't have an unfair advantage. So mm-hmm. some of your listeners might know that free-range eggs or barn eggs are actually, they taste better even than regular right. eggs, which would actually give us an advantage if we were comparing it. So the eggs that we use in our experiments are actually the bad eggs, which is kind of a, you know, unfortunate side effect of our work. But in order to, you know, be compelling when we present the data, we compare the really unsustainable eggs in muffins or cookies or mayonnaise or ranch dressing or what have you directly to our product. And it kind of relates to our central goal that someone like my dad, who I love to death, but, you know, my dad didn't care a whole lot about climate change or egg laying hen welfare. He just wants a good muffin or cookie or mayonnaise that's nice and creamy. And our goal is to give him something that actually tastes better. Not the same, but better.
Better.
And is less expensive. And the cool thing about plants is, you know, it's almost an accident of nature that the end result of a hen's ovulation cycle does all these amazing things in food. It does. It does incredible things in food. But the thing about an egg is, it is what it is. It causes the muffin to rise or be moist in a particular way, or it holds oil and water together in mayonnaise for, you know, so many months. But with plants, man, you can go beyond. You really can. You can make mayo actually last longer. You can make it creamier. You can make the muffin rise more or actually be moister. So some of what we're doing now is actually going beyond it and not just trying to replicate. We're done with the whole replication. And now we're thinking more and more about how can we be better? How can we, you know, convince someone like my dad, not only is he going to save money, but the cookie actually tastes, feels better than the cookies he's used to eating every single day.
Well, you don't have to convince me, but there's a whole world out there that you need to convince. I've been a vegan for 25 years, and I spend a lot of time in the kitchen. I love to cook and create great recipes, and I love to feed my friends and neighbors who aren't vegan or vegetarian and have them go nuts over the food that we make here. I know that the power of plants, and I know that we can make incredible tasting food compassionately, sustainably. But you mentioned your dad, and I'm really into a primarily whole or minimally processed diet, and a lot of us that are in this food movement are going in that direction. But there's a huge population that doesn't mind eating a lot of industrial processed food, and they don't care what's in it. They don't know what's in it. Occasionally, they hear about pink slime on the radio, and they get a little nutty. But for the most part, nobody knows what's in their food. They don't even know if it's egg or not egg.
No, that's true. And, you know, when you really step back and you realize the magnitude of the problem, just with eggs, 1.8 trillion eggs laid every single year, and that number is going up. It's not going down. And as, you know, as exciting as I think the flexitarian and vegan and vegetarian, more sustainable food movement is in the United States, every day, every single day, the percentage of eggs from battery cage facilities in our food system increases every single day. And that's mostly what's happening in China, in developing countries. I mean, we have a nation of 300 million people, and that's just a tiny percentage of all the people on the planet here. And you're right, the vast majority of people aren't looking. They're not paying attention to it. And I think, you know, our central question that, you know, radiates in our brain every single day is, with the world exploding to 9.5 billion people by 2050, according to UN reports, how do you create a world in which human beings thrive, have enough protein, have cheap protein, cheap food, without ripping up the environment, without massively abusing animals, without sucking up all the world's water? And part of the solution, I think, is plant-based food companies and plant-based approaches to this really vexing problem.
My background's in chemical engineering, and I always wanted to believe that I could do good things with it. And there have been lots of great things that have been done with chemistry, and then some ugly things that have been done. And a lot of the ugly things have been related to food. So it's really good to know that science is being used to do something good.
And what we do with science is, you know, it's not, we're not doing in vitro meat. We're not doing DNA splicing. We're not doing synthetic engineering. You know, maybe it would be better for popular science if we would, but we're not doing that. What we're doing is sort of acknowledging that we have a world of plants out there, and the vast majority of those plants are entirely unexplored. It's almost an accident in terms of the plants that we've decided to use in our food products. And we search aggressively all of those plants, we characterize them, we understand their functionalities, and then we work in a really creative way with our culinary team to bring them together. But it's probably a lot more natural and, you know, from the ground than it comes off.
Here's a chicken and the egg question for you. You mentioned Bill Gates and how you were mentioned. I read it in the food for the future at the mm-hmm. Gates Notes.
Yep.
Where
yep.
they mention you, and they also mention a company, Beyond Meat.
Yep.
So there's Beyond Meat and there's Beyond Chicken. Who came first, Beyond Meat or Beyond Chicken? Are you related somehow?
No, well, we're actually around at least the name first, but you know, they do a lot of good work. My buddy Ethan Brown is a founder there, and they're doing a lot of positive work, and have been really successful with their really awesome product, which is actually really, really good.
Yeah, absolutely, and. What do you think about people that are raising chickens on their own in the backyard?
You know, I got to say, if that was our food system, if the eggs that were being produced were from backyard chickens and they were laying eggs, and the eggs and the meat and the chicken that we eat for meat were in people's backyards, I definitely would be doing something else. I spent about 7 years of my life in sub-Saharan Africa working on poverty alleviation, working on environmental sustainability, working on water scarcity issues in some of the poorest places in the world. And I'm personally very driven and focused to find solutions for the most urgent needs, the most urgent needs facing, you know, not only this country but around the world. And, you know, that is really the limited exception, people doing that. And I think it is much better than 99.7% of where eggs and chickens come from. And it's, you know, frankly, our company's goal is if people end up doing that, you know, that's their business. We're more focused on, you know, where the massive impact is and where the ability to have really wide scale deep changes, and that's conventional egg production.
So can we get Beyond Egg products in our stores yet? Or is this available for industry only?
Yeah, both. So it's available for industry right now. We'll be in a number of different grocery stores within the next 3 months. But right now, if anyone is interested in really staying in touch with what we're up to, if you just go to HansonCreekFoods.com, you can sign up. We send out a weekly note to everyone, and we'll update you on where you can find all of our products.
Is there a story behind Hampton Creek?
There is. My best friend in the world lost his dog a while ago, and his dog was named Hampton. And it was really the only time I've ever seen him cry. And he was the inspiration behind this idea and really getting me to think about where our food comes from. And it's a way of recognizing him and his role in making this happen. And then we added Creek on the end of it because it sounds like a regular old food company.
Right. It certainly does. Now, what about yourself? When did you start on this vegan path and discovering the power of plants?
I'm 33 now. I've been vegetarian since I was 21. I played football at West Virginia University. And as soon as I stopped playing football, I became vegetarian. And that's, you know, pretty much all due to the impact of my best friend talking to me about how animals are raised.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, you know, the way I like to think about it is, you know, when you look at a mother pig in a gestation crate or an egg laying hen in a battery cage, you know, besides the suffering element, which is obviously just hit you in the face, you know, what really moves me is just how absurd it is. It just it doesn't seem to align with where the world is. It seems like it's so yesterday. And so many areas of my life, I try to be today, and I try to be tomorrow. And it just seems so yesterday. And you know, since I was 21, I've really been trying to make sure my values and the values that I talk about are aligned with what goes in my mouth.
Well, I appreciated what you said before about working on something that is so big and needs to be changed sooner than later. All factory farming needs to go away. And I'm not quite sure how that's going to happen, if there's a way, maybe Beyond Meat is the company or a number of others, to eliminate the animal for meat as well as eliminating the animal for egg.
Yeah.
But these things need to end, period. It's probably the worst thing humanity has ever created.
Definitely.
And I had a question, and it slipped away. Okay. Well, other than what you're doing now, do you have some future ideas, or you're just focusing on the egg concept?
We're pretty focused. We'll probably take this and do something else with it after we have the impact that we all want to have. But for right now, it's all about the egg.
You know, it's all about the egg, but it's also all about money. And a lot of us have lots of ideas about how to get people to eat healthier or make this a more compassionate world, but it takes money to make change. So I see you've got this great business going, but there had to be some incredible investors and supporters to get behind this project.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can really, you know, for those out there that have ideas about doing something, I think there are kind of two ways to do it, and we picked a second. And the first is to really lean into an idea in an incremental way. So to really test it, not spend a whole lot of money on it, and to begin selling. Maybe it could be online or at your local farmer's market or, you know, depending what sector you're in, just to test it. And sometimes you don't need a whole lot of investment for a lot of ideas, depending on what the needs of the business are. And there's actually a great book called The Lean Startup that talks about how there's a word they use called ooching, how you sort of ooch into an idea. And then the second approach is more similar to what we did. One's, I don't think, necessarily better than the other, is we had an idea, and I gathered a team together, and then we were lucky enough to work with an investment partner at Coastal Ventures, which is all about solving some of the world's most pressing problems. And they decide to back us because they see that it's a broken industry and it really needs change. But I think both approaches work. And I think, you know, the worst approach would be the third, just thinking you can't do it because you don't have the connections or the network or the resources or yada, yada, yada. Mostly that's probably yes. You can figure out how to do it.
Right. And I think part of it is what you mentioned at the beginning of the show, and that is to just create something completely different.
Yeah. And then a little game we like to play with ourselves is, you know, what would happen if we didn't do what we're trying to do in 30 days? If the world or a person you care about most or something that you really want was gone, like, how would you approach this differently? If everything matters, and how would I have raised more money for this if I didn't raise a certain amount and the world vanished? Would I, you know, be able to close these deals if, you know, nothing else matters? And it gives our team, I think, a real intensity of focus. And I think for any of your listeners out there that really want to start something, you know, as intense as you think you might need to be about it, try to up it by about 20, because it really requires an almost obnoxious and absurd intensity to make something like this happen.
Very good advice. I know with myself, there's just too many things I want to do. And I know for making a business happen, you really need to focus on that one thing.
Yeah.
I tend to spread myself all over the place. But there's a lot of things that need to be done, and I like to do a lot of different things. Well, Josh, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. You are amazing, and your company is amazing, and I look forward to seeing very positive changes because of Beyond Eggs.
Terrific. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Well, wasn't that something else? I can't wait to see what happens when Beyond Eggs takes over the egg industry. Let's see it happen. I am Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Take a look at responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my website. And there's so many recipes up there that do not use eggs. Certainly, for decades now, we've been figuring out how to use some very simple egg alternatives that work really well in the home. And you can find them at responsibleeatingandliving.com. And we're going to take a quick little break, and then we're going to be talking with David Bednarik, who wrote the book Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology, and I can't wait. Hey, everybody, I'm Karen Hartglass. And you're listening to It's All About Food. It's the second part of the program here on May 7th, 2013. And I want to remind you, send me an email at info@realmeals.org. We can continue today's conversation or any other conversation you'd like to start, especially if it's about food. Love to hear from you, and I like to know what you're thinking. Okay. Now, let's move on to the next part of the program. My next guest is David Bednarik. He is a counselor, attorney, teacher, and author. He spent 8 years teaching psychology and philosophy on the faculty of the University of Phoenix and taught it in the Navy, at 3M, the American Society of Training and Development, the Process Work Institute, psychological associations, and small groups focusing on personal growth. He received notable awards for teaching, employee development, and legal services to the community. And he's the author of a new book, Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. Welcome to It's All About Food, David.
Thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure being here. It's a beautiful day here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm 7,000 feet in the mountains and enjoying the beauty today.
Okay, I was wondering where you were, because I thought if I had a problem, I would want to see you.
Oh, thank you. And I would tell you that you have no problems, and you would say, why am I with you then?
I like to think I have no problems, but we all have issues, one small and large, and that's life.
Yes,
sometimes,
absolutely.
I think that if we didn't have issues, we wouldn't be here.
Mm. Amen.
But I like your approach. This is a love-based process that you have. And that's very important because I think that's when it all comes down to it. That's why we're here, and that's all that matters.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't get that.
Yeah. I wrote the book and talking back to Dr. Phil, Alternative to Mainstream Psychology, and I focused on Dr. Phil not because he's the person to go after, but he's a straw man. He represents a way of thinking that many of us think inside. He says to his guests on his show, well, how's that working for you? Well, what are you thinking? As if people are doing the strange or disturbing things they're doing because they're screwed up somehow. And we can agree or disagree with that, but that attitude very rarely helps,
mm-hmm.
and it leaves people feeling more ashamed of themselves. And then when it doesn't work, when I say, well, is eating that ice cream working for you? And you say, well, no, it's gaining me weight. Then I say, well, then stop it. Well, you don't need a psychologist to tell you that, right? We tell ourselves those kinds of things all day long, feel worse and worse about ourselves, but the improvement doesn't happen.
Well, let's look at history for a moment. I want to think that we're evolving, that we're getting better, mm-hmm. although there are plenty of things that are going on in the world today, and I really wonder. But when it comes to psychiatry and psychology, these things have moved. We were decades or hundreds of years ago, people were analyzed one way or another, and I think we've come a long way. But there's a long way that we need to go. And I think your approach is definitely in the right direction. Now, I don't watch television very much, but I have caught Dr. Phil from time to time, and I've never liked the show. It always makes me feel kind of creepy.
Right.
And I feel the same way when I watch many Dr. Oz segments or The Doctors. And you made some analogies about how we treat emotional and mental issues and the way we treat physiological issues, health issues. We tend to focus on one thing. We're a terribly reductionist society. We don't think of the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And your idea of the whole incorporates a number of different things, and definitely important, like the family or other people, your community, and we're all participants in everyone's issues.
Mm-hmm. That's so important, actually. Thanks for bringing that up. Not many people actually raise that issue with me, because I wrote quite a bit about family and community and part of psychology. For instance, psychology, I think, took a good leap when family systems ideas came out. And family systems therapy said, if you and I are partners, Karen, and we have little Johnny as our son, right? And
mm-hmm.
little Johnny is doing things that don't look so good, where he's breaking something, or he's spitting at a bus driver, I'm thinking of different clients, right? Or something like that. We think, let's send little Johnny to therapy. Well, that might be helpful, let's say. But family systems said, Johnny is part of our system. That means he might be expressing something that you and I aren't. Maybe you're not spitting it out and saying something to me, or maybe I'm not, you know, saying, that's it, let's break this idea, let's break this notion between us, so to speak. And if you and I aren't doing that, then little Johnny might. So family systems called the client, the child, the identified patient, but actually the family is. So
mm-hmm.
in that case, what most people don't realize is we're all part of a biological family, parents and siblings, but we're also part of a community. So many people look at themselves and say, what's wrong with me? But many of the things people struggle with are not only theirs. That's such a radical idea for people to internalize, but it's so true. There's internalized issues. Internalized sexism, for instance, is a very big part of women's struggles around body weight and dieting. We could talk more about that. But many women look in the mirror and they look at themselves not looking the way they want to look. They don't think that their diet dilemma and struggle is part of a cultural problem, and it surely is.
It is, and I love the way, as I mentioned before, these analogies are really the same, where we need to treat the body as a whole, and we need to, if we want to repair a community, we need to treat it as a whole, and when we need to deal with these issues you're talking about, it's not just the individual, it's their surroundings and the people involved. And I'm jumping around, but
please do, yeah.
Denial. Of course parents don't want to think that they're to blame,
mm-hmm.
and they want to send their child to an expert.
Right.
But
right.
Of course they're participants in the problem, and I don't know why it's not obvious, but I guess it's hurtful to acknowledge that we contribute to a problem.
Yeah. It takes a certain level of, call it maturity, call it eldership, to take a hit, take the responsibility without beating oneself up. So if I don't have enough love inside of me or around me and the people who are around me, and you say, David, sometimes you talk too much. That's true about me, by the way. I do. I've talked to leaders. I've gotten that feedback many times. So it's true. But if I don't feel good about myself enough, even when I hear that truth, I won't be able to say, you're right, Karen, let me back off and make more space, because I'll end up being so self-hurtful afterwards that I can't afford that, as it were. So it's not because you're not telling me the truth. It's because psychologically I can't afford the hit. It's too big a tax for my psyche, and I'm going to have to go to sleep and feel ashamed of myself. That's not such a good result, right? So
right.
It takes a certain level of development to say, what is my role here, without walking away thinking, oh, I'm a terrible person, or I'm a terrible parent, et cetera. That cost is too much. And then the person can't parent well either, right?
Well, for the next 20 minutes, I want you to talk a lot.
Okay. Thank you.
Don't
I'm laughing.
Over.
My students are kind of going, no, don't say that.
So this show obviously is all about food, and I really believe that most people's food issues have to deal with emotional problems. Some of them are obvious. Some of them are so not obvious. You spend a chapter on it, but actually some of the other chapters, addictions and denial, I connect with people's food issues as well.
Yeah. Food is there for all of us, so we can all project onto it. We could all work. It's a relationship we have, like many other relationships, and then we can do our dance with it. So in that way, it's not only always an easy mirror, but it's a good mirror in the sense that it shows things. And like you're saying, the things that are going on for people are very, very rarely known. Most people think they're eating, let's say, for certain reasons that are almost never the reason. Let me give you an example. I could talk to a person who says, I want to stop eating ice cream. And I said, okay, why do you think you eat ice cream? Well, it comforts me, they'll say.
Mm-hmm.
And then most people will stop there, and many people would say, oh, that's true, you may need more comfort. But if you examine it with that person, that's very rarely the case. And how do you do that? Then I would say to the person, what kind of ice cream you like? And I'm thinking of somebody who said to me, I like salt caramel ice cream, she said. I think that's a great flavor, the salt and the caramel and the sweet. So I said, great. And then I said to her a very basic, what I call love-based question. What is it like for you to put that salt caramel ice cream in your mouth? Not your guilt. What happens to you when you taste it? It's a very simple question, but never asked. And she said, what do you mean? I shouldn't be eating it, right? It's bad. I said, I know. What happens to you? Imagine putting it in your mouth. And she goes, I said, that's it. What's it like? She said, it's like a singing in my heart. This woman said to me. I said, tell me, can you hear the singing? And why I'm asking that question is I want to know what her experience is. I think her experience is going to be meaningful and telltale. And she says, yeah, I can hear it. It's like these nuns who I hear singing in the church, but you can't see them. They're in the background. It's like the angels singing. Now, this woman had a very important and deep spiritual life. She identified as being a Christian woman, a good parent and a spouse, great. But somehow she was still looking for something. She was looking for the angels singing. And in that taste, she got a little taste of that also, a little taste of the angel singing. So her remedy, as it were, for eating less ice cream was to listen to the angels more. That means to take more time to pray, to listen to certain kinds of music that connected her with her Christian faith, with Jesus for her, and things like that. People's hungers are never meaningless. I've never seen them be, well, I'm just stupid. They don't need
something. Well, I love that, and I love that. You started in the beginning of your book talking about how these symptoms that people have are really like a map to guide us to what it is we want and we need if we only would look at them in the right way.
Beautifully said. I want to write that down, by the way. Symptoms are a map.
You know, I realized when I said it, I said, he didn't say it this way, but
I know it.
Sometimes
people say things and I think, why didn't I think of saying it that way? I'm thinking of a woman, that's a story I've told before because it's so funny, who was she was a pot smoker and she wanted to stop smoking pot. We could say she was addicted to pot. Some people would say that, whatever. But she was doing it and it wasn't only good for her and she wanted to stop. And so I said, why do you do it? And she said, it makes me feel good. Well, most of us would say, well, that makes sense, right? She's doing it. She smokes pot. It makes her feel good. That's what she's looking for. She's looking to feel good. And then I said to her again, the basic, what I call loving question, can you tell me what it's like when you put that marijuana to your mouth and inhale it? What happens to you? And she says to me, I don't feel anything, she says. And I said, that's interesting. You don't feel anything? She says, no, but my husband, he gets really stoned, she tells me. So I say, well, that's interesting. How can you tell he's really stoned? I get this one. She says, he looks smaller to me. So of course I had to make a joke. Oh, you know, that's a lot of drugs to have another person shrink. But she didn't get my joke. But
right.
But she was a woman who felt
very small in her relationship. She was older, socialized to be a listener, to be a good quote-unquote wife. So she had shrunken her powers, her intelligence, her personality to fit in. So the reason she feels so good when she smokes marijuana is not because it makes her feel good by itself. It makes her feel bigger. It makes her feel like her own size. And feeling her own size makes her more confident around her husband. They have a much better time together than when she's shrinking, trying to listen to him, being a good spouse. Right? Now, she would never have known that. She just, right. No one ever asked the question. So her program, her addiction program, is to start practicing being more whole, more full, the bigger, her bigness, as it were. Then the marijuana won't have such a grip because it's doing that job for her.
Well, I'm not a psychologist, and I think I'm going to use this question, what is it like when you do such and such,
yes,
with some of my activism work. Now, as you may know, I'm a vegan, and I promote a plant-based diet, and my motive has been for a long time, since I was a teenager, not to create pain and suffering, exploitation, killing sentient beings. And then it expanded into other things when I realized that plant foods are healthier than animal foods and they're gentler on the environment. And I like to share this information that I've discovered with anybody who wants to hear it. But it's always been, I don't understand why people want to eat animals or feel comfortable eating animals, or why when they know factory farming is going on, why they would continue to support it. And some people don't care. Some people do. But there's this denial factor, which I likened a lot to your later chapters when you talked about abuse and domestic violence. And not wanting to recognize the pain. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's such a huge thing. I didn't expect you to go there. I got a little, my little heart got some tears in it. My wife Lisa is also very sensitive to the hurt of animals. Anyway, so your theme and topic touched me, and I first want to say thank you. Thanks for standing there against. Against opposition at times, and taking those hits. And anyway, thank you for that. It's
you're welcome. You know, when you were mentioning going through your own discovery with domestic violence and seeing, wanting to look away of the pictures of a woman that was abused, and then causing yourself to look at the picture, I think that was an interesting discovery, and I want to. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, because I need to work with that information with my own work.
It's a huge thing. If you Googled domestic violence and you got, of course, you would get, you know, thousands and thousands of search results. But many of them, many articles, books, videos would have the word silence in it. And they're using the word silence in that we are, as a culture, still relatively silent about what's happening. Not just the perpetrator and the victim, as it were, but the culture itself, relatively silent, relatively blind. We're not noticing it. I could hear somebody screaming in the other house, but I say that's not my business, right? Or I can look at somebody that I may know, or a friend, or potentially even a client, and they might say, I'm fine. And I can see by their gritted teeth or something in them, it's not quite true. People do that with their children. I had a client who was anorexic. She was a size zero. Her boyfriend criticized her for having a butt too big. Right? So she would go to the gym. This is awful. She would go to the gym and exercise, but she had no food in her. She would have like broth and non-fat frozen yogurt. So she would go to the gym and she'd pass out and end up having ET people coming and taken to her emergency room because there was no calories in her to burn. She'd come home even after all that, and her parents would think, I don't understand what's wrong. You look so beautiful. And it's like, hello, right? This is the mismatch, right? And in that way, we're not seeing violence. This woman she's in a violent cycle. What to do about it is a complicated question, but there's a violence going on internally, probably in the family, as we were talking about, but it's not seen. So So anyway, the Dr. Phil show you're referring to, he had a woman on, a man and a woman, and she had bruises on her chest that you could see were like handprints, and colored bruises on, and on her arms, I think it was. And I remembered after the show not really wanting to look at the pictures. And I remember her saying, it's not that bad, really. We're doing better. And then I think he says something like, on the outside, people would think we're just doing well. So I started thinking, how come people don't look? So I sort of made myself look at those images. And then I noticed all those feelings come up, like the way they do when most of us look at somebody who has a, who's been wounded or has blood. We get queasy, right? We want to look away. It's not only easy unless you're used to it, looking at hurt. So anyway, so that chapter sort of is a chapter of my own inner work, looking at what does it take for me to be available to another person's hurt, to not need to, quote, make it better, you know, heal it, fine, but make it better so that I feel more comfortable, or have them smile so that I feel more comfortable. It's a very deep dynamic within violent scenes also. So those people who are in violent relationships emotionally or physically, it's hard to even look at oneself and say, that's a bruise. I'm going to sleep at night criticizing myself. I got injured, right? We think, oh, you have low self-esteem. Maybe, but maybe that person got injured. Probably somewhere along the line.
Mm-hmm. You think this pulls for myself, because I know people don't want to look at what's going on in factory farming. It's very painful.
Yes.
And we need to see it. Often we just, and we take in that pain when we consume these foods. Yeah. Okay.
There's a culture, and this is not the whole culture, but there's a part of our culture says, don't worry, be happy, which is good at times, good message. But at times says, as you're kind of implying, don't really look. Please put a smile on your face, right? Please say, I'm feeling bright today. Please say, I'm prosperous. Please say, I'm in the light. Please say, blessings to you. Please say something positive. All of which has a good intention most of the time. But there's a shadow that is quite dark. I think Jung said, the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. There's a shadow that's quite dark where there's a lot of very powerful things happening to the planet, to the earth, to animals, to ourselves inside. And that takes a little bit of heart and depth and openness to your own pain, to not try to fix somebody enough to be open to theirs. Then they might want to share with you.
I think I really enjoyed reading this book and reading your example. I was uncomfortable reading about Dr. Phil and the way he managed these cases that you talked about, and I also wonder about the people who want to be on his show. But that's a whole other phenomenon. But I think we can all really benefit from understanding what you've put out here in terms of how we evaluate things. You started on the beginning talking about us all being so judgmental, and I didn't even realize it, but I was smiling saying, oh yeah, we do this all the time, where we've taken little pieces of modern mainstream psychology and incorporated them into our own selves, where we think that we can judge things around us, and most of our judgment doesn't understand the deeper significance of what's going on.
Right. A lot of us, in a sense, we all practice psychology whenever we self-reflect. Why am I doing this? I'm a procrastinator, right? I'm not disciplined enough. I'm too quiet. I'm not quiet enough. I talk too much. These kinds of self-criticisms or other criticisms pass as psychology, meaning we sort of start to diagnose ourselves and try to change, right?
Yeah.
I know why I'm not losing weight. I'm sitting on the couch too much, somebody once said to me. This is a woman who tried to lose weight and gain weight and lose weight and gain weight, which is the most common result of weight loss strategies, for 30 years. She says, now I got it, right? I figured myself out. I've analyzed myself. And then I sort of asked her the basic questions. Tell me what it's like to be your size, to have a big round belly, or to eat the foods that you do, or to sit on the couch. You think it's a terrible thing to sit on the couch? She says, well, don't you? I said, not yet, I don't. I don't know what you're doing there. tell me what it's like sitting on the couch. And then she says, well, I like to watch National Geographic shows. Oh, interesting. Tell me about that. I love looking into other countries and imagine being somewhere else. Tell me more about being somewhere else. Oh, I was in the Peace Corps for 6 months, and then I traveled once for 3 months to Asia. Oh, my gosh, she says. I said, wow. She goes, I lost so much weight when I did that. without a diet program, without making herself run each morning. Not that running each morning is a bad idea, but her as soon as we took her out of mainstream culture for her, she instantly lost weight by herself. She's living in a culture inside of her and in her job and in her relationships that doesn't fit for her. So she goes off somewhere else. She sits on the couch. So if I don't know that, I say, get off the couch. But now that I know that, I know she needs to, quote unquote, sit on that couch more, meaning live more of a National Geographic life, live less of an American culture life. That's the help that she needs. Running for 15 minutes a day might help, but it might be too good of an American woman, right? You know, doing her jogging. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with jogging. Amen. But her psyche says that's not what she's looking for. She's looking for something else.
So the next question is, people can ask themselves, if they can't go and see you in New Mexico, obviously, and they want to find a way to lose weight or eat a better diet or improve some sort of emotional problem, they ask themselves these questions, and then does it normally find the solution? How does that work?
Okay. Well, I have to do a little bit of self-promotion statement because I've been shy to tell people, but I do phone work and Skype work all over the country and usually can figure out making time for people. But anyway, that's my shyness. Please forgive me.
Good for you. Let me say, you need to do that.
The first thing I think it's useful to do is if people can voice, even out loud, in front of somebody else or themselves, the criticisms they have, either for their eating or their bodies, say them out loud because inside they're like insulated from critical thinking, from diagnosing. Many people, if they hear the voices in their head out loud, are aghast at how brutal they are to themselves. I think 97% of women are considered cruel to themselves around their bodies. Mm-hmm. Not only, you know, so and men also, although talked about less, and there's less social pressure, so it's easier for men. So the first thing I think is to notice, just become aware of how rough that environment is. If you heard a friend, somebody you love, talk to themselves that way, or somebody talk to that way, you probably wouldn't just stand there and say, "Oh yeah, sure, you are a piece of whatever," you know. You would say, "Oh my gosh, you know, that I can't stand that." So that's that reflection. But then the second question, what is it like? That does take some care. Don't try to answer that question in 2 minutes. Make a therapy session for yourself, at least 15 minutes. It's not an hour, right? To answer that question, it's really worth reflecting on. What's it like? And then if people can do that, imagine, if it's a food thing, imagine tasting that food. And then if I was talking to a large group of people, I'd say, imagine a song that goes through your head that is similar to that feeling. I imagine Blue Sky or something. I like the Allman Brothers, right? And then I'd say to them, if you could, if you're free enough, make a little dance to that that music. So now,
David, this is great, but we're out of time. So,
oh my gosh, we can't be out of time.
It went really quickly, and you talked a lot.
Okay, I think
it was all good. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed talking back to Dr. Phil. And where can people find you?
Great, thanks a lot. They can find me on talkingbacktodrphil.com. That's talkingbacktodrphil.com, and the book is 18 chapters. It's got all kinds of stories and approaches to large range of topics, and they can see there Psych Today articles and articles in many different magazines and some videos. If they want to just get some good free advice, they can go there as well.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Karen. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Send me an email, info@realmeals.org. Visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. And have a delicious week.